When I talk to a group of people and I say, hey, how many of you seen a kiwi in the wild? I want more than two people to raise their hand because it's still a really rare thing. People don't have a natural encounter with our native bird.
Hello. Kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified.
Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna, and I'm super excited for today's episode because we are joined by Michelle Impey, the CEO of Save the Kiwi. Kia ora, welcome Michelle.
Kia ora, thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us.
It's great to have you here. We're very excited to talk about all things kiwi conservation. So would you like to start by introducing yourself and Save the Kiwi?
Yeah, sure. So I am, as per the title, CEO of Save the Kiwi. So I have the lucky job of sitting at the helm of a team of 21 very talented people who are, as is in the name, working hard to save the kiwi. So we're headquartered in Auckland, but have a national reach. And our sweet spot really is supporting community and Māori-led conservation initiatives. So we work very closely in partnership with DOC, but very much focused on those kind of grassroots initiatives and the work that they're doing to save kiwi, often in their own backyards.
Thank you. And before we dive deeper into what that actually looks like, can you please give us a brief overview of kiwi?
Yeah. Oh boy, I can talk kiwi all day. Yeah, so quite interesting. So in my role, I talk quite a bit to, you know, schools or corporates, whatever. And it's kind of across the board, I would say there's a light understanding of our national bird in this country. So kiwi, when we talk about kiwi, quite often we talk about it generically, but there are actually five species of kiwi, and they are spread from the north of the North Island down all the way to Rakiura or Stewart Island. So they're lighter in numbers than they used to be, but span the entire length of the country. So five different species, and just like humans, they all have different characteristics. So the North Island brown kiwi, very different from Roroa or Great Spotted Kiwi, for example, in their breeding cycle, their family structure, etc. So quite fascinating in that way. In New Zealand, quite often the question we get asked, how many kiwi do we have left? And the answer, no one knows exactly, is the starting point. So we're not counting every one of them, of course, but based on best information we have, we estimate probably around 70,000. So Department of Conservation does the official population estimates, and that was last done about 5 years ago. But that was the latest figure we have. And quite often in conservation, you know, if you're used to hearing, oh, we've got, you know, a couple of hundred takahe or down to 100 and some kakapo, when people hear that with kiwi, they go, oh, wow, they're doing really well. And compared to some others, they are. But what we have to keep in mind is how sharp and steep the decline has been. So before humans arrived in New Zealand, we would have had millions, potentially tens of millions of kiwi everywhere in New Zealand. So the decline, it has been rapid and it has been steep, but we started in time. We have huge momentum and, you know, thousands of people with the will and energy to do the work to save them. So that's where we're at with kiwi in general. Wow.
And I think it really helps that we identify so much with them as a people. We are the Kiwis, right? If you had to pick three favorite Kiwi facts, what would they be?
Yeah, there's so many. I love this question. Okay, so what? So people think that Kiwi lay the largest egg relative to body size in the bird world, and they don't. They're close. I think there's a petrel, there's a seabird that is, you know, relative to body size bigger, but it's still an enormous egg. So it's, if you think of a bird that's, you know, slightly larger perhaps than a chicken or a hen, but they lay an egg the size that an ostrich or an emu would lay. So it's enormous. And the fact that usually gets the crowd, usually the ladies more so, to kind of grimace, is that would be the equivalent of a human giving birth to a 3 or 4 year old. So an enormous egg, one of my favorite facts. They have, incredibly, one of the shortest bills of any bird in the world, which seems counterintuitive because we know they have this very long bill for probing around, right? But in the ornithological world, sorry, the bird world, they measure the length of the bill from the nostrils to the end. So because kiwi have nostrils on the tip of their bill, when you measure from that to the end, the result is you have a very short bill. So kind of a funny fact that, although technically it's true, isn't really. And probably there's so many cool facts about them, but I love that Kiwi are going to say they never skip leg day. So people often think they're, you know, this weak, docile little bird. And of course, they've got threats that can kill them, things that they aren't used to, but they're quite stroppy. They're, and you know this, Anna, because you work with them. Oh, so their legs are powerful and strong. This is what they use for, obviously, getting around because they're flightless. So they run around with their legs. That's what they'll use to dig their burrows. It's what they'll use for defense as well. And we've got a number of really amazing videos coming from the field of people that have field cameras out on, you know, a possum trying to get into a kiwi burrow. Or even I saw one of a rabbit trying to get into a kiwi burrow and the kiwi fighting them off. So I love that they're feisty and stroppy, and they got the big old legs to help them in that cause.
I find quite often Anna comes home and she's covered in scratches and celebrating that the kiwis have ripped her arms apart.
Wild females are the best kiwi. They are, their characters are just simply amazing.
Yeah, it's good. I always find if we're doing a kiwi release event and you get one that's quite stroppy, like it makes it a little awkward for the kiwi handler sometimes when you've got a kiwi that's wriggling. But I always go, yes, that's one of the strong, feisty ones that's going to do well in the wild.
100%. They're awesome, eh? They're just, they draw you in and they just don't let you go anymore.
Yeah, they're probably a healthy addiction, hey? Yeah. It's one of our trustees, Rude Kleinpest. He has a saying which is very true, and he goes, you'll never meet an ex-conservationist. And it's very true, right? Like once you get into this gig, it just becomes, you know, if it wasn't already, it's part of who you are. So yeah.
That's very true. It becomes part of your identity and
absorbing.
Yeah. When did you start your work with kiwi? When did it all start?
A million years ago, when the earth was cooling, I started. No. So quite a long time. So the trust was officially formed as a legal entity in 2002 or 2003, and I joined in 2005. So I have been there coming up to my 19-year anniversary, which is an incredibly long time. But I always say it's like I've had a new job every year, if you will, the same title, but a new role. So when I started, I would say the org chart was one square. It was me. So we had a CEO or an executive director, as the title was in that day. And at that point, we were sponsored by BNZ. So they were our naming rights sponsor. And that came out of an existing relationship between BNZ, Doc, and Forest and Bird to do something for, you know, some of our top threatened species, including kiwi. So I've been there since near the beginning when we grew it from a boutique sponsorship of BNZ, if you will, to with, you know, when they withdrew, and then we had to seek our own funding, you know, other sponsors, other donors, and then grew the team underneath us as the cause nationally grew.
Wow. So it really has evolved in the last 19, 20 years into this major initiative for kiwi and all over the country.
Yeah, it's been massive. The rise of community conservation in New Zealand has just been incredible to witness. And it's, I mean, not just in kiwi, but I think this mirrors what's been happening across the country. So when I started, the majority of the work was being done by Department of Conservation. So probably if you want the dial it back a little bit in kiwi conservation with how this all started, we would say that like probably it's only as recently as kind of the early 90s that it really triggered the National Kiwi Recovery Program. So prior to then, you know, with the introduction of stoats and cats and dogs and rats and everything that's on four legs and has fur essentially has been introduced to the country, and it's been horrendous. And I think there was a point where they kind of thought they'd reached equilibrium in the wild with, you know, the introduced predators and our native species, and went, okay, they found that equilibrium. And the reality was it wasn't true. Our natives were continuing to decline. But with kiwi at that point, it was kind of this, people knew that they weren't seeing them, they weren't hearing them, they knew they were disappearing, but we didn't know the answers to basic questions. We didn't know what the major threats were. We didn't know where we still had them, and we didn't know how many we had left. So the early stages of the National Kiwi Recovery Program were research-focused. They were all about answering those questions. So one of our founding trustees, Dr. John McLennan, answered those questions for us. So he used to be with Landcare Research at Manaaki Whenua. So it was his research that was really instrumental to tell us that stoats predating chicks was the major issue out there. And we have this horrible stat we still use that 95% of chicks that hatch into an area without predator control will not survive the first year or two of their life. So they get decimated by stoats. So the research phase that answered that, we went, okay, we know stoats are enemy number one for chicks. Now we need to do something about it. So that's really what started what is now this national program where DOC established 5 Kiwi sanctuaries, which some are still functional, some aren't. And it was the beginning of the rise of community conservation. So the first community group on the Coromandel Project Kiwi, which is still in existence, has been around since the beginning and going strong. So we've just seen it over the years, as the tools available, the momentum, everything's, it's just grown this upward trajectory in the work being done out there.
Wow, I find it so fascinating how community has been woven into Kiwi conservation. And it's also interesting to think that when you started, the idea that stoats predated on kiwi eggs was, and sorry, kiwi chicks was not known. It's almost taken for granted in the world of kiwi these days that's a requirement.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that advances in science come to feel like they're things that we always knew, but they weren't. But it's focusing on the community aspect. What is the role of community in kiwi conservation, and how did their initial response spark off and evolve over the years?
Yeah, look, and I think it started from the fact that, you know, we're very fortunate in New Zealand. People still have kiwi in their backyards. So I always say kind of sometimes with these global causes like Save the Whale or Save the Panda, whatever, all you can do is, you know, advocate or give money. Whereas with kiwi, people like physically still have them on their land and can be hands-on involved in saving and protecting them. And I think that was really the genesis of it. I mean, we kind of see right now with, you know, perhaps our current government doesn't have a strong focus on environment or conservation. We've got Department of Conservation that's responsible for a third of the land in the country and have a minuscule budget to try and do that. So, I mean, that's it's always been an under-resourced industry. And I think for landowners, they've recognized that and gone, we know DOC can't do everything. That's no criticism, DOC. They're not resourced to do everything. So if we want kiwi to survive, we need to take it into our own hands. So quite often with a lot of groups, how they started, it would have been a landowner with kiwi in their property going, okay, I'm going to get some traps out. I'm going to do the work to start protecting them. They talk to their neighbors. All of a sudden you've got a community group that's trapping a larger area. They start talking to more neighbors. So that's probably simplistically how it started out. But to answer your question of the role of community conservation now, they are so sophisticated in how they operate. And I think probably when we talk community conservation, it's probably worth thinking it's a broad category. When we talk about community, we're basically saying not DOC or not council, but a community group can be anything from a couple of landowners working together. You kind of go, yay, we're a community group, up to the sophistication of Sanctuary Mountain Maungatauturi, if you will. So it's a very, very broad range. But the role now is fundamentally they manage a ton of land that's protecting kiwi and other threatened species on it. So the work on the ground, community has a huge role, but they're also leading a lot of, you know, innovation and science initiatives and research. Just they are an integral part of this now, and it's been, I think, a shift that needs to be recognized more than it is, that a lot of the expertise in this industry sits in the community now.
I think it's community groups for conservation are the best. But I think what you mentioned about how you can't do much for whales apart from giving some money for most people, but you can connect with kiwi, is almost a superpower or a hidden strength of the space. Because when you can get involved and you can actually do something about it, and it's not, oh, can the government do something for us? The fallback is that there's always a bunch of locals that care, that they're not going anywhere, and that's only going to grow. So I think it's amazing how it's evolved.
Yeah, it's so empowering and it's so rewarding too. You know, like you see the results, like you do predator control and then it's, oh, look, a kiwi chick on camera, like it works. So yeah, it's quite amazing. And it is with the advancements too. Like you'd mentioned earlier about how things we take for granted that we thought we always knew, or even technological advancements. Like the advent of field or camera traps, we call them traps anyway, but cameras, field cameras that are motion triggered cameras that you can get for a couple $100. Like the information they're giving us and like the content for storytelling is just incredible. So just all of those kind of things there just adding up to such a cool industry of people doing good stuff and being well informed to help guide their decisions too. It's probably the key.
There's so much, and you already mentioned it, there's so much knowledge within the community. Sometimes it's site-specific, but sometimes it's yeah. this discovery of, look at that footage. We didn't know that Kiwi do that, that they behave that yeah. way. Or we presumed that the chicks may stay longer with mum and dad that we sometimes give them credit for. And now we actually know that, hey, yeah, that's what's happening out there. And that's just gives you hope yep, and exactly. gives you motivation, right?
Yep, exactly. And on the, I mean, it's cool for the Kiwi content. They're also goofy, hey? You see a lot of footage of them like tumbling and rolling. It's quite funny. But also on the predator control side too, right? Because this is what's also helped us understand stoat behavior. So we have this thing now called trap-shy stoats because they're incredibly clever animals. And we believe it's now multi-generational that they teach their young to avoid traps. Like they will have learned what they are. And we see on these field cameras this footage of the stoats doing everything but flipping the middle finger to the camera because they're like, you know, jumping on these traps that, you know, kind of up and around them, everything but in them. Like they know. So understanding that behavior and going, oh my God, okay, which is what's led to, you know, our ultimate prescription for keeping Kiwi safe is to do a toxin pulse every few years to get rid of those really clever stoats that are now trap shy. So yeah, incredible information coming out of the field.
Leading to the next question, what else but predator control do actually Kiwi need to thrive?
A safe environment is the key, really. And it's, so we always say, as long as they've got enough kai or enough food and they're safe, they'll thrive almost anywhere. So they're incredibly resilient and adaptable animals. And I think this is one thing people think, oh, they need pristine native bush, you know, deep in, you know, the ideal is like Kaharangi National Park where, you know, they're a million miles from humans. But the reality is they'll do well most anywhere. And we see this in like pine plantation, in beaches, in alpine areas, of course, in native forest, farmland, like they'll do incredibly well. You know, quite surprisingly, there doesn't need to be that much bush for them to tuck into to roost. And they'll, they love blackberry. Ask the people that have to catch kiwi. It's like gorse, blackberry, all the prickly stuff that they have to dig them out of. Really, as long as they're safe and they've got food, they will thrive. Those are the big things. So habitat loss, which is quite often impactful for threatened species. Like, yes, of course, because habitat loss usually means, you know, it's wide open, there's no bush, there's no cover, and or it's urban development. So of course that makes it challenging, but yeah, quite resilient and adaptable. So, which is why the focus is on pest and predator control to grow kiwi populations.
Coming back to something you said about your top three kiwi facts, I was really hoping you would mention their vestigial wings. Aren't those little mini wings just like so confronting? You think this bird's going to have some big, big flocks and then it's like a little chicken wing?
I know, it's great. Most people think they don't even have any wing at all, right? Because when you see the profile of the animal, it's just smooth. No, they're little vestigial wings. Look, there's so many cool facts about them, you know, like, if you want a fourth one, favorite one, is that we're not really sure, like for a nocturnal animal, I don't think we're really clear on how good their night vision is, which is unusual because you think of most nocturnal animals with their big eyes that allow them to see at night. So we're pretty sure that their navigation is more their sense of smell, hearing, and, you know, they use their whiskers like a cat to find their way around. So just like a cool but bizarre little bird, hey? In a lot of ways. Like, I love them, but they're bizarre. Maybe that's why I love them. I don't know.
I think it definitely plays into it all, how strange they are. They're so unique, and it's such an experience. It's so different to anything else working with them. I think that's what builds that Kiwi addiction in a way. And that's why I didn't ask you, hey, Michelle, why kiwi conservation? But instead, I want to ask you, what keeps you going? What keeps you motivated on a daily basis to protect our icon, our national bird?
So many things, hey? So many things. And you'll know this once they get your hooks into you. On a personal level, it's been so rewarding from a career perspective. So I've had the ability, I guess, to kind of flex my entrepreneurial muscle. So I've been able to build, you know, this trust or this organization into, you know, a culture, an ethos, you know, a work program that I would love to work in. So I feel really grateful for that, that I've been able to, you know, grow it and to have that environment. Like, I love our team, which is great because I've been able to handpick most of them. So, like, it's an amazing team of people. It's an amazing co-papa. So from a career and personal perspective, that, and it's amazing. And we see that for people that come to us, if they're not already in conservation, it's quite often people leaving the corporate sector because they want to do something for the greater good, right? They feel that I don't want to just help a company sell more products. So there is that amazing thing. But also it is just the people we work with, and you'll know that, Anna, too, you'll run into them every day. It's So I'm from the corporate world initially, and there are great things about it. There's probably more money in the corporate world than there is in conservation, a little bit deeper pockets for budgets. But you end up working with just such a large selection of people that are doing things for the greater good and for the right reason. So the motivation and what drives people in the sector is very different than the, I guess, if you think a ladder climbing or financially motivated industry, because no one is saving kiwi to get rich. That is abundantly clear. So yeah, there's a lot of things about it. Mm.
What I heard from that is people quite a few times, and it comes back to this, people and conservation and nature are in our modern day and age inseparable. If you think about conservation, and I talk to someone who's not involved, quite often they think, oh, it's just planting trees and walking away and having a barbecue. Yeah. Maybe not the barbecue part, but the planting trees and that. But when you get in, pull back the hood and you get into conservation, the people are so integral to it. And so here's a question about people. On a nationwide scale, what does Save the Kiwi want to achieve for the people of Aotearoa, New Zealand?
Do you know what? I want everyone to be able to have a natural encounter with kiwi. So we have our kind of vision is from endangered to everywhere. And it's, I guess we kind of have a little bit of a different vision. So DOC is very focused on, I think they're like stamping out fires everywhere, trying to prevent things from going extinct. So they work to a model of persistence, just make sure things still exist and they're still there, right? Hang on to them. Whereas we're like, we want them to be abundant. It shouldn't be like when I talk to a group of people and I say, hey, how many of you seen a kiwi in the wild? I want more than two people to raise their hand because it's still a really rare thing. People don't have a natural encounter with our native bird. So that for me would be it. And I think what comes with that as the multiplier effect of that gift to New Zealand is not just being able to experience it, but if we've got kiwi everywhere, we have a really healthy natural environment. So it means not just kiwi, but a lot of other things that share the habitat will be there. It sends a great postcard to the world from a tourism perspective to go, wow, we are known for our natural beauty, our native environment, all of that sort of stuff. And to be able to say, look what we did, like we brought a species back from the brink. Because you think like most people know the story in the USA of the bald eagle, right? When they were using DDT and it was, I think it was like the shells were really weak and damaging them and they stopped and the eagles made a comeback. Like that's a story that's really well known. And it, like, yay, good for you, USA. But like, I want that story for New Zealand to go, yay, we brought our national bird back from the brink. It's thriving. It's everywhere. This is representative of how much New Zealand cares about its natural environment. Hey, everyone, come see it and spend your money.
And I think stories are what we connect with. As a marketer in my day job, I often say we evolved out of caves and into this global society through storytelling. And it was through that we were able to expand our consciousness as people. And I think we can look at stats, we can look at data, we can look at all different quantitative metrics of success of a conservation program or anything in this world. But ultimately, storytelling and connecting to the emotional center is what gets us going and keeps us going. not just in conservation, but particularly in conservation.
Case in point to stories, it's such a good thing you bring up, Callum. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Pai Maunga project in the Harokumara Ranges, so East Cape. So it's over 100,000 hectares that's flanked by Te Whana Apanui and Ngāti Porou, or the two iwi. So they got funding, it's not Jobs for Nature, but the same era, to initiate pest and predator control across more than 100,000 hectares that has had nothing. It has been neglected. It is decimated. It's really sad. But, you know, just on the storytelling thing, so incredible. What they did, it was a very grassroots-led initiative. And what you need to protect that landscape at that scale is aerial toxin. There's no two ways about it. You cannot do that with a trapping program. And I know it's a very controversial topic and we don't want to get into that one, but that's the reality for that kind of landscape. That's the only way to knock it back. And it is a controversial topic. So the storytelling aspect of that was they started with telling the story of what's been lost. So they took their kōmatua deep into the bush to see. So they have so many, even the deer are starving. Like they've eaten everything. They've eaten the undergrowth. There's nothing. So there's these mature trees, bare roots, no undergrowth, nothing. Like when it rains, the hills come down to the sea because there's nothing to stop it. So they took their kōmatua in and they're like, you know, he's in tears, this one that was on video going, oh my God, I haven't been back here in so long. So it was telling the story of what's been lost, the story of what could be. And then it became, how do we do this? And it was through that storytelling is how they got their iwi, their hapu on board with what needed to be done to protect it and resurrect it. So they've just finished this year, the last treatment block to get toxins there, to just really get a big hit back on all those pests and predators. Oh. So yeah, storytelling, hugely impactful. Hugely.
Wow. Take my hat off to that. That's a really interesting story.
It's quite a massive achievement, eh? So yeah. Yeah. So good stuff happening out there. And again, you'd go by our definition, I guess that's a community or Māori-led project. But again, to my point earlier, I have the scale and sophistication of what's being driven by non-government or the typical entities you'd think of that drive this work.
Oh, it's simply inspiring and one of my highlights this year so far. I was incredibly lucky to be part of the Mango Tsotiri Kiwi Translocation and work with some of your team. And how cool is that? Okay. That overarching community effort, you know, transporting kiwi from the Waikato as far down as Taranaki and Wellington, and it's community driven and it's absolutely inspiring.
Isn't it unreal? That's just the perfect. So if I would have thought 5 years ago, I didn't realize how much we were aligning with, particularly with Capital Kiwi in Wellington, right? So in a space of 5 years, so the work at Maunga Tautiri, incredible, right? 3,500 hectares of predator-free fenced habitat. And if anyone hasn't been there to visit it, they need to go because it's amazing. You go, that's what New Zealand is supposed to look like, right? When you see that old growth native forest. So for us, this is what we look for. We're not a huge entity and we don't have the deepest pockets, but we kind of look for opportunities to leverage off the hard work of others. And that's what this piece of work was Maunga Tautiri fence sanctuary. They had some kiwi in it, but not a huge number. We went, okay, we're going to use this to build a source population. So over a series of 4 years, we used Operation Nest Egg, which means sourcing, I know you know Anna, but for your listeners, sourcing eggs from wild kiwi, incubating them in captivity, and then we put the chicks at about 3 or 4 weeks of age into the fence sanctuary because it's predator free and kiwi chicks can live near independent from hatch. They stay there, breed, grow, it becomes, because it's a closed population, it starts to fill up and we can then every year transfer the juveniles who would not be able to establish their own territory to safe places in the wild. So over the course of 5 years, we put, it was over 300 chicks, I forget the total figure, onto the mountain. So they've now grown, they're breeding, and this is what has started this process of, you know, every year. This year we got 222 kiwi off the Maunga out to three different sites in the wild. So when we had started that initiative, Capital Kiwi in Wellington were starting their pest and predator control program. So it kind of culminated at the same point that they were ready. They had 24,000 hectares of predator control habitat. We were working with a mountain that was full of kiwi. It was a marriage made in heaven. Because Yeah, I'll say in the old days, because we're kind of really trying to change the kind of scale that we're working at in conservation with this. But typically, to establish a new kiwi population, we would need a minimum of 40 unrelated founders. So that's kind of the magic formula. And typically, you would put 10 or 20 on the ground, monitor for survival, and then trickle the other 10 or 20 in over the next 2 or 3 years, which is fine when you're doing kind of a wild-to-wild translocation and, you don't want to diminish the source population. But in this case, we're like, okay, they've got 24,000 hectares. If you put 40 kiwi on the ground, it's going to take them decades to, breed and disperse and actually take advantage of that safe habitat. And we've got a mountain that's full of kiwi. So it's just brilliant. We can rapidly create a natural wild population that can benefit from all of that hard work for that predator control.
It's so amazing. And it's inspiring. And there's so much positive stuff going on, especially in kiwi conservation. How can we bring that hope, those good news to the everyday household? Because quite often conservation news, the headlines, they can be quite grim, but actually a lot of it isn't anymore.
Yeah, there are good news stories. It's a real tricky thing in this industry, right? Because we, like everyone, we need to find that balance between, it is still urgent. There's work to be done. There are challenges, we need support, blah, blah, but not paint such a grim picture that people feel it's a hopeless cause, because no one wants to hop on a sinking ship, right? So, but you're right. And it's finding that balance of telling the good news stories, because there are a lot of them. We know where we're doing the work. We're growing the population. We're like so many good news stories. So yeah, it is the balance between that. And I'm with you too. And I think in the early days, we were the same. We were kind of like, oh no, kiwi could be gone before your grandkids are, we kind of went a little too hard, I think, on the doom and gloom side. It's like, kiwi are going to be gone. And then you kind of go, why would anyone want to support us? Like, if they're going to be gone anyway. So it is a tricky balance, but you're right. It's, I think we're living in an era right now where it's pretty easy to get overwhelmed by the negativity and, the things that are happening from a funding level, from a global perspective, sometimes I just turn off the news, guys. It's just negativity after negativity. And you go, it's not helpful.
No, but in reality, saving kiwi, it's such an achievable goal, right? Like, we're onto a success story here.
It totally is. And the thing we always say too, like, of course, kiwi are our core business, but it's about so much more than kiwi. So because kiwi attract, publicity and funding, and it tugs the heartstrings more than a carnivorous snail or a gecko will, if you will, we feel the opportunity and responsibility to really make the most of, the resources that come to kiwi benefit really broadly, and to make sure we make the most of that. And we know it, but it's nice to have the proof of it. So there's, again, just with community and the sophistication of them, there's a project on the Coromandel Mahikoro, who has, some of they're a really incredible group, but one of their volunteers and trustees, so she's been doing gut analysis of ferrets that they catch in their traps, because she's like, I want to find out what they're eating. And it's quite alarming. She found a lot of hens and feet from our native frogs, so from hoxetters and archies. Wow. In the gut of this ferret. It's quite a compelling photo, just with like the ferret lying there and all the little frog hens in there. And you go, that is horrible. And it's not surprising, because they're protein hungry animals, same as stoats. So of course, but it just strengthens that message, because we target ferrets for kiwi control, right? So you go, yay, take the ferrets out to protect kiwi. Look what else benefits the frogs, and you can guarantee the geckos and, many other birds. So yes, good things happening with kiwi, but the multiplier effect of what we're doing for kiwi is so great. And it helps those less charismatic species, if you will, that don't attract the same level of funding and support.
Yeah, and I think ecology and ecosystems by their very nature are complex, and seeing some of the negative things that happen in conservation is not attractive to a conversation that people always want to be a part of. But enabling people to engage at the level where their curiosity is now and their knowledge is now, and letting that curiosity grow like a seed that you've planted, is such an important part of it, right? Like, if someone learns one species in the forest and what role that plays in the wider ecosystem. Yeah. Next time they might notice something else that's growing on it and find out, when you start talking about kiwi, they might think, hey, how does that actually tie into their life? I don't think you can jump into being a full-blown conservationist from not being involved in conservation overnight. I think it's a natural path and that curiosity grows within you.
Yep.
I know for me, I used to walk in the forest and think, what are these trees? I want to know what they are. What are these birds? What is that funny sound I hear? And every time I go in there, something new comes to me. Even if someone doesn't tell me or I don't read a book on it, I notice that something's different out of season. And it's just, I think that organic growth and just letting your curiosity guide you is just so important but also so fun and liberating.
For sure. And look, I think sometimes people come to it accidentally too, right? It's like, oh my God, a possum is eating my fruit trees, or, you know, get the little bastards. So, I mean, it's kind of funny how we all enter. I always say that too. Like I was in this gig for a while, and then I'm like, okay, now it's personal, because we had a rat that chewed through the electric passenger side airbag in our ute. And I'm like, oh my God, that is an expensive replacement. I'm like, jeepers, that's one rat. I'm like, all right, it's personal now. But yeah. So yeah, it is, and it does start naturally. And I say that too. I just, like, one day you wake up and go, oh my God, I'm a bird nerd. And you see how it trickles out into everything else in your life, right? Where you go, yeah, it's about saving kiwi, but I'm like, oh, so, you know, my partner and I have replanted, he's got some of his family land in the far north that we've got a batch on. So we've converted it from paddock to native forest. Like, we've put 5,500 stems in the ground. And you go, and all of that, so I know that's not about saving kiwi, and we'll probably never see a kiwi on our land in my lifetime where it is, but it is about, you know, it's like you say, come, I'll just, the little things, hey, you start to connect the dots and you go, oh, okay, if I'm saving kiwi here, like I put a trap here and I plant a tree here. And then it's like, why isn't that tree growing there? And you're like, oh, because it has no protection. Oh, we need protection for it. Or whatever. It's just so, so interconnected. And then we get the grandkids out and you go, okay, you guys are going to help us plant trees because you need to understand what this is. And of course they grumble and moan, but years later they come back and they're like, is that the one I planted? And you're like, no, the one you planted died, kid, because you didn't get it straight. But we lie and say, yes, yes, it is.
Oh, definitely. That's so true. I remember when I was at school, I was planting some Manuka understory, and, you know, they're these little 30 to 50 centimeter seedlings at the time. Yeah. And it was just a reason to get out of the classroom. And I thought, this is great. I don't have to look at this whiteboard and try not to distract the teacher. And then we came back there. I was walking with a friend, I don't know, 10 years later, 5 years later, so later on anyway. And there was this full-blown bush. And I was like, I planted that. I feel so proud. I'm going to pick up that piece of rubbish now. Yeah. But saving kiwi. Oh, sorry.
No. I was going to say, it's just kind of back to that whole it's so empowering thing again, right? You can see tangible results of your efforts. It's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. Saving the kiwi should be everyone's mission. And you recently appointed Kiwi ambassadors. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. And it is exactly that. I often say that we need to get conservation out of the green corner. So, you know, the people that are like, they're there, they love it, it's the right thing to do, they're doing it. And you kind of go, how do you make it relevant to the rest of the country? And I say, like, conservation needs a bit of a rebrand sometimes. I think we need to make it cool, which I know we think it's cool, but just for everyone else. So, yeah, so that's kind of the point of the ambassadors is, you know, people that are respected, but in an industry outside of conservation. So we've got, you know, some very respectable athletes, Kane Williamson and Lisa Carrington, who are in the fold, which, you know, it's great. They've got a long following. They're really genuine in this. So for them to help amplify the messages is awesome. So Lisa's dog, Colin, has his own social channels, by the way. So when she came on board, we're like, cool, we need you to talk about, you know, what it means to be a good dog owner. Because it's, you know, it's more impactful coming from her than it is from us, you know, a conservation organization. So yeah, so it's a pretty impressive lineup we've got. We've got an author of kids' books, Kat Quinn. So she's authored Kiwi the Kiwi kids' books, which I think they've surpassed Harry McClary in sales, like quite incredible. And she's from strong conservation credentials. So she'd contacted us when she was drafting her first chapter and said, this is what I'm thinking, what do you think? you know, keen to partner. We're like, hell yeah. So she's donated, I think, over $60,000 from sales of her books, which, so I mean, wow, amazing. She's not a household name, if you will, but an ambassador, in that she is doing what she can through her network. And then, of course, we've got Ruud Kleinpass, the bug man, who's entomologist and a bit of a media celebrity in his own right. But yeah. So yeah, it's been quite powerful. Probably the most powerful message we could send. Actually, we call them patrons, but it's with Helen Clark and John Key. So we brought them on board specifically to help us launch our endowment fund, which we set up a few years ago. And it's really interesting. So our chairman knows John Key quite well. They used to, like, years and years ago, were on the trading floor together decades ago. So they've known each other since way before John was prime minister, and they both live in St. Stephen's Ave in Auckland, so see each other on the regular. So our chairman had approached John about coming on board as a patron, and he was the one that said, yep, but if I do this, we got to get Helen too, because this needs to be bipartisan. That's so important, the message it sends to the country, which is very true. So yeah, we're pretty fortunate. And I guess if Kiwi can't draw that support, I don't know what can, right?
Yeah, I think to your credit, the whole idea that conservation has many faces and many stories and many angles is that if it's just coming from the greenies, so to speak, it comes across as this niche field in the corner of the room. But I think talking about it from different people and from different perspectives and to different audiences is really critical to making this different. You know, we say that the only way that we're going to have long-term meaningful change for our native species and for our habitats is to change the culture. And I really sincerely hope that this ambassador program takes a few steps towards that end.
Yeah, it'll be a couple of bites out of the proverbial elephant, right? When you look at everything that needs to be done to shift that over generations, right? And I always, you know, I get hope from things like when you look at smoking, right? Like when you go, oh, it used to be normal to smoke indoors, or like, I'm old enough that I've been on flights where they had a smoking section for, like, which is kind of a joke when you think about it, right? You know, you think about now, we all wear helmets on our bike, or we all put on our seatbelts. And these are things that weren't normal behavior a generation ago, right? So I take hope from that and go, you know, like, we're doing the hard yards now of talking about predator control, and it seems weird. We have to kill animals to save animals, but that's the reality here. But you go, that's becoming normalized. And to be clear, normalized in a humane and ethical way, not just kill animals, bloodlust. So I do take hope from that. With everything that we're all doing on the advocacy side, the education side, and sometimes you go, oh my God, is anyone hearing the messaging? They are, and I think we're going to see that long-term shift. Like, there's a conversation happening nationally at long last about cats and a potentially contentious issue, right? But one, you know, it's a conversation that needs to be had. Same with dogs, right? So you kind of go, beloved family members, but responsible dog ownership. Like, I think we'll just go, that's normalized. You don't take your dogs where they shouldn't go, or you don't let it off lead where there's protected species. And, you know, for the most part, they're great. We still have a few that aren't. And I just, it'll continue to shift. I think it will just continue to head the right direction. I'm an optimist.
Oh, and I fully resonate with that, Michelle. And I think once that curiosity is there, most people just naturally pursue it. And if sometimes it's the best thing you can do is tap into other people who have a keen interest but are not a conservationist, because sometimes you need to hear it from somewhere else, right? It's like if you're a kid and mom tells you not to do that, sometimes you're not going to listen because she's mom. But if someone else who's got nothing to do with that tells you, then you're like, oh yeah, sure, I'll change my behavior. That's Lisa, if you don't take your dog there, maybe you're right.
Yeah. And so frustrating for the person that's been saying it all along. And then someone else says it. You're like, this is a great idea. I'm going to do this. I get this all the time with my partner. He's like, I saw this most amazing thing on YouTube. And I'm like, I've been saying this forever. But it doesn't matter, right? As long as the message gets through and you get the right stuff. And look, we have to accept, too, there are some people that will never be on board. Like, the rights of their dog will always surpass that of wildlife or whatever. And that's humans. But I think as long as we keep shifting the numbers and we get the majority there, we'll get where we need to be.
we are achieving things, right? For example, my most inspiring fact at the moment is in 2022, North Island brown kiwi were officially reclassified from at risk declining to not threatened, but with the asterisks of being conservation dependent. That's such an amazing achievement, and it's just amazing. But what does that actually mean, especially with that asterisk hinting at the conservation dependent?
Yeah, the asterisk is probably the most important part of that classification.
Oh,
so
yes.
One of two things. One, it's positive. It recognizes that the work that's being done is making a difference. It's moving the needle. And that is huge, because for the first time since this program began in the early 90s, a kiwi has been taking, you know, moved from from threatened to a not threatened status. But I think for those of us working in the industry, it doesn't change one iota what we were doing or what we will do. So the conservation dependent part is where it all sits, because we know if you stop predator control, it goes backwards. So I guess it depends which audience you're talking to. For people that support and volunteer, and like, yes, of course, yay, it makes a difference. You know, we're making a difference what we're doing. Here's the evidence of it, but really it's about we can't let up. So don't take that as job done, because we need to keep going. That's how I see it.
There's so much hope for kiwi. And I think as long as we keep up mahi and our communication and changing the narrative, we can do anything. We can achieve anything. But how can we improve the education and advocacy sector to get even more people on board? What needs to change, or what needs to be more focused on to make sure that this becomes more of a household everyday conversation?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of what we are doing, but there's, I think for some people and maybe younger kids too, there's a little bit of a disconnect with nature. And I know there's a big movement to try and get this, you know, experiential learning, you know, getting kids out of the classroom and into nature. So I think there's an element of a real reconnection with nature that would help this if I look at the education and advocacy side. But I think it's a lot of keep doing what we're doing. So for those of us working in this sector, I think it's quite important that we're consistent with our messaging, that we're clear with our messaging. And I think that we meet people where they are and recognizing that. And I think like dogs or dog owners are probably a really good example of this. And again, I would go, we've changed our messaging, because we used to be pretty hardcore with the dogs and kiwi can never mix, you know, man's best friend isn't kiwi's best friend, which is still true. But you know, it's not realistic. We are always going to have dogs in this country. Hopefully we'll always have kiwi. So it's not a never the twain shall meet, because it's just the reality with, you know, urban sprawl, more people, kiwi are coming to urban areas are going to where kiwi are, they're going to interact. So it's kind of more, we need to find a way for kiwi and dogs to live alongside each other. And that means responsible dog ownership, keeping dogs controlled, etc. So I think from the advocacy side, there's a lot of things. Most everyone in this country, I would say majority, owns a dog, a cat in their household. So when I look at things like that and go what we can do in the advocacy side, it is that finding the what's in it for them if it's not conservation, and go it's about more than just protecting the wildlife, because not everyone cares to the same degree that, you know, the three of us might about that. So I think that's some of the work that we've got to do in that sphere. And Wellington did a great job of this. It's often talked about in these circles with their campaign to keep cats inside. So it was led by social science research, going, okay, they kind of go, what would motivate people to keep their cats inside? And like protecting wildlife didn't even register on the list, but it was things like, you know, keeping them from fighting with other cats, not getting hit by cars, not getting disease, you know, all the things that are going to keep their cat safe. And then they looked at, you know, who's a credible voice to deliver this message to keep your cat inside. And it, you know, it wasn't doc, it wasn't council, it wasn't whoever, it was the vet. So then they end up with this campaign that is a vet, you know, holding a cat saying, hey, keep Fluffy inside at night, it'll keep him safe, and da, da, da. So that's what I mean by like meeting people where they are and finding what will resonate with them. That's to me the role of education and advocacy.
I think it's like a really powerful thing to always do is connecting Like one, of course, meeting that person on their level, but then connecting it back to nature, and be that, you know, water quality or less erosion. But I think conservation is such a broad term that you have to just find what appeals to that individual or to that group. And sometimes the best thing is getting a third party in, like the Kiwi ambassadors. And sometimes that is, you know, doesn't always have to be our classic answers.
Yeah, exactly. Not everyone wants to pull a smelly hedgehog out of a trap, but there might be something else they can do or something else that will appeal to them. Or like we spoke about earlier, it's like, it might not be conservation. It's like the possums are eating all the lemons off the tree. Come at it from that angle. And I know that is how some of the projects, they call it, well, it's kind of their gateway drug, if you will, if that's a kosher expression to use anymore, but kind of to get people in is like, because possum trapping's a little more, maybe a little easier to get on top of, you know, the benefits are instant if they've got fruit trees, if they've got nut trees, whatever that are. So that's sometimes how people kind of lure people, if you will, into the conservation or pest control sector is via that. Sorry. Pun not intended, but good one.
Yeah. that's awesome. What is the future vision of Save the Kiwi? Let's say we were to jump in a time machine, wave a magic wand, and all your dreams came true, and it was in 10 years or in, let's say, 50 years' time. What are we walking out of this time capsule into?
Yeah, yeah. 10 years from now, I would like us to see us for sure into a six-digit population. So we've surpassed the 100,000 mark. Perfect world, Save the Kiwi. And every other organization working to save Kiwi has sufficient funding to do what they need to do. So there's the perfect world. So yes, so I think the trajectory on, we're continuing to see growth of Kiwi. We do have as our first kind of milestone to hit 100,000. So I would like to think that for sure within 10 years, we'll do that. 50 years from now, I would like to see that we're out of business. Let's say we actually have a predator-free New Zealand. We've done enough work that we've got, you know, enough Kiwi on the ground to enjoy that predator-free New Zealand, and job done. We're out of business. That's ultimately what we'd like. As much as I love the job security of the environment we're in right now, I would rather we weren't needed. There's the ultimate.
And we can still go out at night and sit in the forest and just listen to them.
Oh, exactly. Then we'll complain we can't sleep at night because there's so many Kiwi, they're keeping us awake. That'll be a nice problem to have.
Would be one of the, but yeah, like you said, problem solved, tick.
Yep.
What are some practical tips for the everyday New Zealander that they can do to help Kiwi conservation?
Yeah, there's lots of things. So the biggies, donate time, donate money. So if you're fortunate enough to live where there is a community conservation that exists, they probably, I will say, need money. They may need volunteers. And I think for people volunteering, again, back to the not everyone loves to pull hedgehogs out of traps. Quite often for groups, they need professional volunteers as well. So it might be, you know, accounting, legal, marketing, comms, technology, IT support, HR support, whatever, all those things that are not sexy but important for a project, right? Because they want their resources to go to the work on the ground. So I think volunteering, but think beyond just a day of tree planting when you think volunteering, I think would be my message. So donate time, donate money. The other one is going to be around dog and cat control. So if you're a dog owner, I guess just be respectful of the rules that are in place for where you're taking your dog or where you might live. So if there are areas where your dog needs to be on a lead, keep it on a lead. If there are areas where dogs aren't allowed, please don't go. And then, oh yeah, my dog wouldn't chase that. So it's just about, I guess, being a responsible pet owner. For cats, which is, I know, is a more contentious one, but if we're to separate feral from the pet cats, let's tackle the easy one, which is feral. Those feral come from unwanted, dumped, you know, lost pets, unfixed pets, etc. So I'll say for that, if you have unwanted pets, like please surrender them to a shelter, don't release them to the wild where they're going to establish. And it's cruel to the animal too. They then have to fight for their survival in the wild where they're not used to it. So lots of things there. And I guess if you're in a position where, you know, maybe you work in the corporate world and you can influence a sponsorship decision or something to support an entity, I guess it's just think about what you do in your everyday life and how that might support a conservation. It can be support Save the Kiwi, of course, but support your local community initiative in some way.
Yeah, I think play to your strengths is such a good insight. Mm-hmm. Speaking of conservation, it has different meanings to everyone. Michelle, what does conservation mean to you?
Yeah, to me at the high level, it's leaving this world a better place than I found it. So, and it's whatever form that takes in my everyday life. It's the basic, you know, recycle, use less plastic, etc. It's just, man, lower the impact we're having on this world. And it's hard with how it's geared right now. I drive my car, I fly, because that's how we get around at the moment. But that's what it means to me, doing lots of the cumulative effect of incremental gains, if you will. I really love that expression, like lots of little stuff adds up to big impact. And that's when I think conservation.
Compounding interest.
Yes, and it's also incredibly powerful when suddenly you realize that all of those baby steps are adding up and building a picture.
Yeah, for sure. Little things, they all make a difference.
Especially if you get the community on board and then we all start doing these little things. It's just, yeah, slowly but surely, right?
Yep, agree. Like, again, you think, how often do you see people throwing litter out their car window now? Like, you don't. It used to be a thing, right? You'd be driving behind someone and go, oh, there's like the fast food wrappers go out the window. Like, and I know there's litter is still an issue some places, et cetera. But like, I feel like in general, it's better, right? It's better. We have this, we get it as a population. You don't throw your rubbish on the ground. It's great. It'd be the same thing. Don't let rats live in this country. I don't know how that translates, but it is just that shifting mentality, eh, of going the right way.
For sure.
And we're getting there. You know, I'm seeing a lot of small changes, a lot of people picking rubbish on the beach, knowing that that makes an impact. You know, it's kind of cool. I've seen little kids tell off other people at a birthday. In Old Town in Manuku, they do have kiwi. And the kid went up to the dog owner and said, please don't take your dog in here. And how powerful is that? And you also can't say no to that, really.
That's so good. Exactly. They always talk about that, eh, with like, if you can get the kids, right? It's like buy one, get two free because they go home and tell their parents. And I don't know. I don't know if that always happens. Like, I don't have little people in the house, but it's kind of also, you hear the parents that are like, so what'd you learn at school today? Nothing. What'd you do today? Nothing. So I don't know, but I agree. And again, it's that whole having the message come from someone other than the traditional, you know, us or doc or whatever, like who is going to be that trusted voice or that voice you can't say no to deliver those messages. And again, it is that whole, again, that social norming thing, right? Where you go, you'll get other dog owners policing dog owners, right? And going, oh, hey, mate, you shouldn't be taking your dog in there. Just like, you know what I mean? So it shouldn't have to be an animal control officer or doc or like, not that we do this, but Save the Kiwi out there doing that. You know, it needs to, and once you start to build that, the majority swings, right? And then all of a sudden you're in the minority if you're that person that's like, you know, got your dog in the bush where it shouldn't be.
And then suddenly conservation is cool, right?
Whether or not it's cool, it's happening.
Hopefully both would be great.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. So it's been such a pleasure having you on this show. It's been really enlightening and I learned quite a few things about Kiwi I did not know before. How can people find out more about you? How can people get involved and get in touch?
Yeah, logical one. Head to our website, so it's savethekiwi.nz. You can donate, of course, securely online, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on our socials just to find out what's happening, and you'll see things that pop up from there. We don't have a huge need for volunteers ourselves, but we can certainly connect to projects that might. So yeah, head online, check us out there. And we would love to have more people signed up that we can talk to in our database. So even if you start there, that would be fantastic.
Cool.
Hey, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us and talking Kiwi with us today. It's been a great pleasure. Kia ora and thank you.